Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
Even starting from very young, you know, when you first start drinking, I was always the one even then that was just legless, a mess, hospitalised, stomach pumped, all that kind of stuff.
In terms of that illness, at what point were you able in yourself to make a divergence off that path? Was that a decision you made yourself? Were there other factors in play that made you go, right, this is a bus I've got to get off at this stop?
You know, had this pandemic happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago even, when I was still in the midst of the craziness and my alcoholism, I really fear for what would have happened to me. And it just kind of hit me with an overwhelming sense of gratitude.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Okay, next guest on Mental Health Monday. A brilliant guest who I've known for a number of years now. And she's been involved in a million and one different things based around the internet, based around football, based around blogs. She's won a couple of awards as well. She's got her own YouTube channel. Sarah Halpin is our guest on Mental Health Monday. Sarah, thank you for your time. How are you?
Thank you for your time. Thank you for having me on and for that lovely introduction there, Mick. Yeah, it's been a couple of years now, hasn't it, mate? So it's good to chat to you today. And I'm holding up okay, I think, in these strange, unprecedented times. Very much a case of up and down. But I can influence that, I think. Sometimes I'm doing things that make me feel good and sticking to it. And then other times when you hit that kind of, you fall out of track with stuff and then I can kind of drop off again. So it's trying to keep that balance, but you know, we're still going. We've gotten through a good solid few months, so yeah, happy for that, and let's hope we can continue to push on, mate.
Absolutely, because I mean, these are, and people use the phrase unprecedented times, and we should ban that particular phrase, but it kind of makes sense, doesn't it, in terms of where people are at, doesn't it, you know, in terms of like, It's absolutely, because nobody's had this experience before. And we'll talk about, you know, where we're at in terms of your own sort of mental health journey as well. This will be a weird thing when we look back, won't it? Whereby people will have these sort of experiences, the highs, the lows, the ups and the downs. But also, there'll also be this big thing like, and then 2020 happened, which for everybody will be almost like a little bit of a strange almost reset point, or there'll be flare-ups, or there'll be mindset changes completely. I think 2020 will be like a, and then that happened. I think people's journeys potentially will go off in different tangents based on what they've experienced this year.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's something that nobody could have foreseen, and it's just totally flawed us, to be honest, hasn't it? And weirdly, I was thinking back to, you know, you think New Year's Eve and everybody, Happy New Year, and New Year, new me, new challenges. And that's certainly been the case. And yeah, I think for years, decades to come, people will reflect on 2020. And, you know, people that maybe are young now will look back, can't remember it properly. But I think being the age we are, we're very much living it, experiencing it. We just had a little chat before, didn't we, about how entire months can kind of just seemingly disappear, and you can't really pinpoint much that's happened. And I think that's what I've started to do the last couple of months especially, is I've become in my own little bubble, and that's not necessarily the right thing to do, but I've just found the longer it's gone on, I've sort of gone more introverted and just focusing, I guess, on taking each day as it comes, because they all become very, very similar. And that's been tough.
I think that's one of the really telling things. And I think this is about the long-term mental health of people, whereby at the end of this period of time, people will look back. And some people, like, we moved house, so we moved to a house with a garden. If we hadn't moved to that house, we'd have been in a little, it was a decent sized house, but it was a terrace house that didn't have sort of outdoor space, didn't have the sunshine, didn't have, you know, a tree that kids can climb and all that kind of stuff. So I felt we were lucky to get out and move to that area. And again, you mentioned like the days sort of, you know, one goes into the next. But to me, like, the days have almost been flying by, and like months have been flying by. But I'm also aware that for some people who maybe were self-isolating, maybe on their own, who maybe never got out of their apartment or flat with no outside space, to them maybe every single day might have felt like a lifetime. So actually this 6 months or so that we've had, to them may feel like almost like a prison sentence, as opposed to other people will go, well, you know what, we had some challenges during the middle of it, or things flared up during it, but we came through it okay and we've come out the other side. I think there'd be a lot of people who will go, literally, it was almost a traumatic experience from start to finish. And we've got to be sort of sympathetic to those people, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. I mean, I'm the same. I've been largely for most of lockdown, I've spent it by myself as well. Terrace house. And like you said, those things, like, I'm lucky that I've got a bit of a yard that catches the sun for a couple of hours in the day. But yet, you know, but I've been lucky that I've had the house to, and I've looked at it that way. I've had plenty of space for myself and the time to do self-care things and, you know, make sure that I'm looking after me. But yeah, everybody's had it different. And some people, as you said, isolated in flats, can't leave the house. Maybe they've been shielding, self-isolating completely. And, you know, particularly elderly people, I think, people that suffer with poor mental health. And, you know, one thing that really worries me and upsets me is that at some point we're going to start seeing the statistics of, sadly, you know, the suicides and things, because there will have been no doubt a spike throughout this, because people, some people are so isolated anyway, and then on top of that they're being made to isolate. So yeah, in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm very fortunate that I know, even when I start to shut down from people, I've always got people that are there for me. You know, it's on me that sometimes I don't do what I need to do in reaching out. But yeah, the people that have spent months just in their own company, not really being able to go outside at all, it is like a prison sentence. And I really sincerely feel for those people. And hopefully, you know, there'll be a lot of support for people after this with mental health. I think it's going to be needed more than ever.
Yeah, I think as well, at the start, there was a couple of people on social media, and it all got a little bit blown out of proportion, but people going, if you don't come through this having learnt a new language, started that book, learnt some new skill, and it was a bit like, oh, get over yourself. Like, if you've got time to do that stuff, great, but this hasn't been a holiday for many people. There'll be some people who maybe are thinking, well, financially it's fine, job-wise it's fine, I'm not really affected by it, I can just enjoy myself. And that will have happened for some people. But for most people, it has been, am I okay? Are my family okay? Are my loved ones okay? Have they got everything that they need? Do I need to go and do some shopping? Do I need to look after my neighbours? Do I have to worry about whether I've got a job when I come back? Do I have to worry about the job that I've got to do at the moment? Do I have to worry about homeschooling? That's been the reality, I think, for a lot of people. Not this thing of, oh, yeah, I'm learning to play the flute.
Yeah, you're right, you know, and I've seen a few of them statuses as well. Like, I remember seeing one that was like, I've lost 2 stone, I've learned a new language, I can play this, I've mastered a new thing. What have you done with your lockdown? And the same as you, it really got my back up, and I thought, who are you to try and shame other people if they're not doing all those things? Because I've gone through stages in this lockdown as well of sort of beating myself up on, I should have been doing this, I could have used this time to do that and this and that. And, you know, sometimes it is a matter of bringing myself back down to earth. It might be a chat to my little sister or one of my friends or my partner, and they'll say, look, you're getting through it. You know, you're getting through each day. You know, you're healthy. You're like, because with how poor my depression and stuff's been in the past, and with my issues with alcohol and stuff, if I wasn't in a stronger place, this could have been really disastrous and really, really dangerous time. So yeah, you don't need people flaunting it. If people have learned new skills and learned a language and they've used the time to better themselves and that, then that's great. But when people are sort of flaunting it in their face, yeah, like, if you haven't done this, then that's on you because you've not used the time. No, you know, everybody's different. And for some people, as I said, just some days, maybe just getting through that day and putting your head on a pillow of a night time and taking that breath and going, got another one done. Sometimes that's all you can do. So, you know, I started out doing my body coach workouts quite religiously for a while, and I was feeling great. But, you know, in typical mental health, sort of you hit a blip with that and then you find it's been 3 weeks without doing one. Yeah. So I need to give myself a kick up the backside, Mick, and get back on that, because I was feeling better. But you can't always do it. You can't always do these things.
Yeah. Today's show will end, by the way, with a flute duet between me and Sarah. We're going to show what we've been learning through this period of time. We do the show now. We're still in sort of the limited lockdown, aren't we, in the middle of August. But most things are opening up and things are coming and going and opening and closing in different parts of the country. But you had a marked anniversary, didn't you? this last week as well. Do you want to tell us about that anniversary and why you wanted to sort of give a nod to it on social media?
Yes, thank you, Mick. So Friday, the 31st July, marked my 4 years to the day without alcohol. And for me, that was just such a big thing. I mean, I always feel that my sobriety birthday, if you like, actually means more to me now than my actual birthday, because to them 12 months, you know, so much can happen. And I didn't ever think, you know, back in my past, I had such a problem with drink and it really was destroying my life. And I know it was going to end up me being locked up, dead or severely hospitalized, or, you know, it wasn't going to be good. So when I finally managed to hit rock bottom and seek the help that I needed and start to get better, my life's just totally transformed. And I think now more so than ever, the fact that I hit that milestone whilst in this crazy time was really profound for me, because I just thought, you know, had this pandemic happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago even, when I was still in the midst of the craziness and my alcoholism actively, I really fear for what would have happened to me. And it just kind of hit me with an overwhelming sense of gratitude. And even though I'm not feeling great right now because of the situation we're in, it sort of brought me back down to earth. And I thought, wow, yeah, you know what? Things are good. I'm very, very lucky and I'm very, very grateful. And I also had a few messages from people that said they've looked at their own drinking because of posts like that. So I always feel it's important to share that side of things. And I feel very blessed, to be honest with you, Mick, to be able to say I've been 4 years without a drink now.
Does it feel like 4 years? 4 years can feel like a very long time, but you'll be aware of where you're at when that 4 years began. Does it feel like that period of time? We're getting on half a decade nearly.
I know. It's crazy. Honestly, like, it doesn't feel like 4 years at all. It feels like it's probably been about 4 months, if I'm honest with you. I remember my first year without drink and, you know, I was going to all my meetings and things like that. And every month you get a coin. I remember like waiting to get to that 12 months to get my 12 month coin. And that seemed to go on forever. I was living somewhere else for my first year of recovery. I've been in Liverpool now, living here for almost 3 years. And in that time, it's just flown. The last three have just flown, you know, truly. And I'm 28 now, and people say as you get older, the time goes quicker. I've noticed that even in the last sort of 5 years or so. So, nearly half a decade. It's crazy. And I hope, you know, continue to take everything a day at a time, but hopefully I can continue for many years to come. Touch wood.
Well, when people look at you now, Sarah, maybe see the stuff you're doing through YouTube, the footy stuff that people will see on sort of national broadcasters, be it Channel 4, you've got your own channels, of course, but you've done stuff right across the board. Do they look at you and go, what, she had a problem with alcohol? Like, sometimes you can see signs in people's, you almost see people's journeys and stories within their face, you know, and the way that they are. But I guess a lot of people would look at you and go, what problems has she had? She seems, quote, normal.
Yeah, absolutely. Or maybe normal. I know I'm a little bit eccentric. I think we'll agree on that one. But yeah, absolutely. I have people saying, you know, I don't understand even with the mental health side of things, or, you know, what would there be to possibly drive you to drink? Why were you so unhappy? Or you don't look like somebody who has necessarily gone through all those hardships. And I think since getting better, that's when I've sort of become more in the media, you know, I've developed a media presence, etc. But when I've got people from that I've grown up with and stuff, more so than people, I've got so much love and support from everybody up here, and it's amazing. But I think when I speak to my friends from childhood and stuff that saw me from a little kid to growing up and going through really dark times, and them all kind of despairing, not knowing what to do with me, to see me where I am now, they really are like, wow, you know. But yeah, I think sometimes people find it hard to believe, because, you know, if I'm honest, Mick, as well, I had a preconception in my head of what an alcoholic was. And I sort of thought you had to be homeless, like lost everything, no family, living on the streets. And, you know, there are alcoholics of that type. But it's in a way it holds you back, because alcoholism can find anybody, any age, any race, any orientation. It doesn't matter. It doesn't discriminate. If you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. And my perceived idea of what one was stopped me from getting help for myself, I believe, for a long time. So never judge a book by its cover, if you like. You know, people might be going through stuff just because they can put a brave face on as well sometimes and smile. There can be a lot going on. I think me and you probably notice things when you have suffered with mental health. I think you know what to look for. But we're good at putting a face on sometimes as well.
Are there things about your behaviours? You mentioned, you know, the preconceptions about what somebody who had a problem with alcohol looked like and acted like. Are there things about your own behaviours in the past which you now think of as being, you know, the surefire signs that you yourself had a problem with alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, it was even starting from very young, you know, when you first start drinking, when you, you know, still even sick, I know you're not legal to drink, but when you're sort of 16, 17, and you and your mates start drinking, I was always the one even then that was just, you know, legless, a mess, hospitalized, stomach pumped, all that kind of stuff. And even from then, and I think when you're younger, it sort of put down to, helping, she's, you know, what is she like? She's a wreckhead. And, you know, sometimes you see that, and there's always the one or two in a group that can never seem to stop and always take it that bit too far. And for me, I look back now and I look at them signs and I'm like, it was so obvious, but I just couldn't have it. I was just, I'm young, I'm enjoying myself. Yeah, I might drink a bit too much, but, you know, if you've got mates that always end up out of control, always end up in a dangerous situation, or yourself, you know, if you can't pick up a drink and just have a couple, and I could never do that, I couldn't go out and have a quiet few or a quiet one, it would end with me being passed out, out of money, whatever, you know, unable to drink anymore. So the signs were always there, but I feel society and the way drink is so embedded as well, it makes it almost acceptable. Mm. You see people like that a lot, you know, in town, etc. And maybe there's more to it with some people.
Did you find that there was that sort of behavior as the sort of the recklessness of youth as you kind of got 16, 17 into your sort of 19, 20? Sometimes people get jobs, then they've got to be up early. Sometimes people have kids and stuff, and they suddenly have to knock that on its head. Were you finding that behavior just sort of continued? There was nothing that for you that went, oh, I should probably stop doing this, or I've had enough of this now. But that behavior from a teenage years took you through into adulthood.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, it was 24 I was when I stopped. And although still I'm very fortunate, I'm still very young to have been able to, you know, knock it on the head, if you like. It was progressive through those years. And at 24, I do have friends that have got married, had kids, even got, you know, the foot on the property ladder with the house, and everyone had their, you know, or they had their good jobs. They were traveling, they were doing their thing. And somehow I managed to hold down a job for like 3 years. And my boss, Sally, God love her, she was great with me. I think she knew I was a good kid. But I clearly had issues, and I'd turn up stinking of ale. You know, I was great with the customers. Somehow I still managed to, you know, but I was very fortunate in that sense. But it wasn't right. You know, everyone was moving on. And if anything, I was getting further and further down this rabbit hole. And I'd go out with friends. They'd stay out till 11 o'clock, want to go home, you know, with their partners or whatever. And I'm, go away. They couldn't get me home. I'd literally stay out. It doesn't matter who, I'd latch onto any group, anyone, just to stay out and have somebody to party with, you know. And I wasn't happy, though. I say party, I wasn't happy. I just needed to be intoxicated. And, you know, it was a very sad, sad time. But yeah, I think it started to, as the years progressed, even though you're looking at what in total, maybe less than 10 years of drinking properly, it was going at a rapid rate downhill, and it is a progressive illness. So I'm just so grateful that I managed to stop when I did.
In terms of that illness, at what point were you able in yourself to make a divergence off that path? Was that a decision you made yourself? Were there other factors in play that made you go, right, this is a bus I've got to get off at this stop, because I don't know where the next stop is actually going to take me?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, Mick, for years, probably my family and friends would have wanted me to get proper help and stuff, and they have been amazing. You know, they couldn't have done more. But as is with addiction and things like that, you have to get to that point yourself. You know, nobody can do it for you. Nobody can make you do anything. And for me, the encounters I was experiencing, the things that were going on, were just getting more and more dangerous each time. You know, every time I'd have a drink, it'd be blackout. I'd wake up, the first thing I'd do is look at the ceiling. Am I in my own house? Am I in my mate's house? Where am I? You know, and I'd ended up going to Blackpool of all places, right? I was seeing someone at the time, and I ended up going to Blackpool. And from the start, you know, at this point, I was trying to sort of knock it on the head anyway. So of all places, Blackpool, and this person I was seeing, I don't think really understood the severity of what I was going through. And you know, we started on the drinks, like, even on the way down there on this bus and the coach, and that whole weekend, I think we're looking at like 48 hours of me just solid drinking. I still can't piece together that what happened in those, and that's terrible still to this day. I can't piece together fully what happened, but I just know that I made it through safe. You know, I could have been killed, anything could have happened to me, genuinely anything. And that for me was rock bottom. I remember the next day having to wait to get a coach home. I was a mess. I felt so physically ill, so spiritually and emotionally just bereft of anything at all, and just thinking, I don't want to be alive like that. And I thought, either I didn't want to take my own life, but I just didn't want to be here. And I always say, if there was a button I could press where I just disappeared, I'd have smashed that button. I wanted out, you know, but I was never going to do anything about it. I didn't think, because I had family and loved ones. I thought, so I'm not going to do that. So I need to get help and I need to change. And thankfully, I ended up like meeting somebody that went to AA meetings, and I still feel like she was like a guardian angel for me, to be honest with you. She came into my place of work and we were chatting. We've been chatting for months over like me working there, but just now and then. And she caught me on a bad day after this had happened, not too long after, and sort of poured my heart out to her. And as it happened, she was a member of AA. I had no idea. And she took me to a meeting and I listened and I heard everybody spoke to me, and I heard the similarities in every single thing. And I went into that meeting thinking, I don't want to be, and I'll get here and I'll realize that probably I'm not an alcoholic. But I listened and I was like, you're in the right place, and best thing I've ever done.
What were those things at the time? Congratulations on that, by the way, and the 4 years. And thank you for being so honest about the journey there. Can I ask you, when, outside of trying to get away from the negative aspects to that lifestyle that addiction had brought, what were those things that you heard about, thought about during that time that offered you a different perspective of like a vision or a goal of where you could be away from that lifestyle? What were those things that were making you think, I can get to that place if I put in, you know, the graft, if you like?
Yeah, I think for me, it was just having to sort of a new way of living, if you like. You know, I had to change certain behaviours in myself and try to learn, like, how to be more positive and more open, less guarded and less bitter to the world. And I'm not religious, but I'd say I'm a spiritual person, and that helped me massively. And I just feel that my passion for sort of football and for Everton, I just started talking and doing more and more little, you know, the Blue Room, obviously I did a lot of work, still do podcasts with them, and a show called Across the Park. I started doing more on Everton, just like a hobby more than anything. That's all it was. That's all I ever thought it would be. And that really gave me focus. So focusing on things that I enjoyed, like football, Everton, and also just the recovery side of things. I think trying to be a better person and help other people gives you so much in your own recovery. That's something I need to get back to more when I can, is doing more work for in the local community and stuff to help others, because that's so good. So yeah, trying to be a better person, I think, releases you a lot of guilt and stuff that you've held on to. And then just trying to focus things into, find something you're passionate about and really throw yourself into that, you know. I think alcoholics, addicts, we are, it's addictive personalities. So I feel like if there's something I love, I'm always going to be, you know, 100% or nothing at all. So just having a healthy outlet for things instead of, you know, poisonous ones. Because I'm always going to have that addictive personality, I think. I'm always going to be, I'll be 80, touch wood, going, you know, going to Bramley Moor, dark and screaming for the blues still and stuff. So, yeah, finding something that I enjoy and using that as an outlet, and also always continuing to try and be a better person and work on myself, because, you know, you can spend a lot of time pointing the finger and looking at others. And I think I had a lot of bitterness in me through things that had happened, and letting go of that bitterness and trying to see the world through new eyes was massive for me. But you still fall into those traps, you know. I still can be an absolute crank when I want to be, when I know I'm not doing the things I should be to keep me well. But yeah, I think Everton's been massive for me as well.
It's interesting because obviously a huge Everton fan, you know, both the men's and the women's side of things do loads of great work heading into the new sort of season as well. The Birdies Blue YouTube channel, so we'll give that a mention, winner at the Football Content Awards as well. But you didn't have to invent that. That was already a part of your life, right? That being an Everton fan, you know, we talked before, didn't we, about, you know, learning to play the flute during lockdown. You didn't have to find something completely new. You just took another aspect of your life and kind of put more emphasis on that, maybe.
Yeah, you, that's exactly right. You know, Everton has been, I've been a Blue for as long as I can remember. You know, it's so important to me, and it's always been there. It's always been there. So that's a natural passion and a natural thing that I've carried with me through my entire life. And my dad even says to me now, it's my dad the reason I'm a Blue. I always say he was from the Dingle originally, born and raised on the Dingle, going Goodison with his dad, etc. So it was always going to be Everton, and I'm glad, despite, you know, some
despite
of the miseries
everything
as well. I wouldn't have it any other way, Mick, I really wouldn't. But yeah, to be able to, you know, I chat to my dad and he says, can you believe that you get to go to Finch Farm and, you know, you've met Duncan Ferguson and Cale and all your heroes? And I can't believe it. You know, I could get emotional. I'm so grateful to that football club because, you know, they've given me they've shown huge faith in me as well. I think, you know, to just be a fan, if you like, I know I was doing media work as well, but because I am such an avid Blue, I think sometimes clubs can be a little bit cautious with that, but they saw what I was doing and just sort of welcomed me in with open arms and have had me helping to do the media content with the women's team for the past couple of seasons. And that's given me such a sense of belonging. I love the staff, I love the team, and yeah, I love that club, and that's just given me so much. And yeah, something that's I've been able to turn into a career, a passion turn into a career. It's not just something that I've picked up and gone, I fancy doing this. Like you said, it's always been there and I just love it.
Have you found that other people who've had similar experiences or, you know, addictive personalities have found other ways of making that out? Because some people go, wouldn't it be great if you became, you know, this big, you know, a big Blue that everyone knew, who you could, you know, go on blogs and YouTube channels and appear on national television talking about your beloved football club. But I'm guessing for a lot of people, it might just be that they, you know, they start knitting again, or they start, you know, playing that musical instrument that they'd learnt as a kid but hadn't played in years. You know what I mean? Maybe it's a reading thing. Maybe it's a going down your local library. Maybe it's a volunteering thing. It almost doesn't have to come, I don't think, with the glamour that you've got, you know, with the big awards nights and all that. There'll be plenty of people who will find that thing that you found, but they'll find it in gardening maybe, or running, or something else.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, strangely, I love what I do with the girls and I love that side of things. But in terms of social media and things like that, actually, I don't enjoy social media because it comes with a lot of stresses. I can have 100 positive comments and one negative one and I will be stewing over that, trying not to bite. You know, that's where I need to improve. So actually, in that sense, that side of things, I don't particularly enjoy. I love the hands-on stuff. I love creating and talking with people. But yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, I think nature, you said then, nature is a great thing. Going out, walking, seeing countryside, knitting. Because I know a lot of people actually who enjoy knitting, young people as well. Whatever it may be, I think for me, like finding like-minded people in recovery is huge, because you've got someone automatically then that you can, if you're feeling a certain kind of way, you can pick up the phone and find somebody that can go, oh yeah, I've been there, mate, you know, and like just getting yourself out there, I think. But yeah, it doesn't have to be glamorous and it doesn't have to be in the public eye. Just find something that genuinely brings you happiness and peace, and focus on that. Exercise as well, I've got to say, for your mental health and addiction, because you can get addicted to that as well. Lucy Spraggan, you know, the singer, yeah, that was off, was it X Factor?
Yeah.
She was always, you know, in Nice Possible Way, she was a little bit overweight, little bit chubby, and, you know, she had songs called Beer Fear and all this. So literally a couple of days ago, Mick, I'm on Facebook or something, and I see this girl, and I'm not even joking now when I say she's got like an 8-pack, arms like this, covered in tattoos. It's Lucy Spraggan, right? She's become like a bodybuilder. She's discovered she was an alcoholic and quit drinking for 1 year, and now she's gone to like this so superhuman, gladiator-esque physique. And it's like, so that's another example. She's obviously quit the drink and gone, right, this is what I'm going to throw myself into. So exercise is a great one. And you know, I think my point is as well, you can transform yourself. Like you can go from something to the complete opposite in a relatively quick space of time as well, if you focus yourself and you genuinely want to get better. And it doesn't have to be addiction. It can be mental health. Find something that's a positive outlet for you and go with that. And, you know, even if you're still doing it in a sort of addictive way, which I know I can with certain things, as long as it's a healthy addiction, you know, that's where to go with it.
And just as you look beyond, you know, the end of lockdown as it is at the moment, the start of the new football season, of course, which will come, and then work will start, and then it'll be next May before we kind of know it, and we'll have European championships and all sorts of stuff to deliver. Do you still feel that past life, do you feel like you're walking away from that past life? Does it sometimes sort of rear its head? Do you feel like, oh, it could be around the next corner if I'm not careful? What is your relationship with the past now, do you think, as you look forward?
Yeah, I think for me, you've always got to pay huge respect to alcohol. I always think that, you know, treat it with respect, because if you get complacent with things, then I think you're walking a dangerous rope. As things are right now, I have no desire whatsoever to have a drink. And, you know, in the 4 years, I've experienced some pretty tough times, and I've still not wanted to pick up a drink. I know where it'll take me. But I think it's very important to be aware of your past and never get too cocky, too confident, because things can change, you know, and you've got to maintain your recovery. I know for me, putting the drink down is one thing, but it's the mental health side of things, Mick. Like if I'm not doing all the things I need to be doing to keep that side of things good, that's when you fall into a danger. So yeah, I always want to be aware of my past and hopefully be able to use that to maybe help others identify with stuff they're going through, and also show that you can get through it, even if you're young as well. You can get through it and you can live a different life. But no, it's very much about moving forward, but always carrying that with me, because it's such a huge part of who I am. And I don't actually think I'd be doing what I'm doing and where I am now if it wasn't for that. So I've got a lot to thank it for, in a messed up, weird kind of way. but yeah, for me, it's looking forward, but I'll always be an alcoholic, but I hope that I'll always be an alcoholic in recovery.
Sarah Halpin, it's an absolute pleasure getting you on the program today. Really appreciate it. Sarah's got a YouTube channel chronicling her TV and footy work. The Bird Is Blue, presenter, broadcaster, pundit, football writer, blogger, and award winner, and guest on Mental Health Monday. Thank you so much for your time. We'll speak again, I'm sure, very soon.
My pleasure, Mick. Really enjoyed it, mate. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.